On Insight Today, lawmakers are set to approve how the state will spend more than $200 billion in the coming 12 months. We'll dig into some of the specifics, including major changes to health care. We'll hear from Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler and Covered California's Peter Lee. Then, helping people with autism spectrum disorder get better-paying jobs. A state-funded program to do just that is coming to Sacramento and Los Angeles. We'll dive into how it works and what companies are doing to hire and retain more people with ASD. And Cap Radio's jazz music director Gary Vercelli joins us for sound advice. He has selected 5 female vocalists with new records to check out. They're all different and all worth a listen. I'm Randall White, in today for Beth Brujak. That's all coming up on Insight. Live from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Randall White, in today for Beth Brujak. Few aspects of California's state budget are clear or straightforward. They require a lot of attention to detail, and you have to keep up with multiple hearings and twists and turns in negotiations between lawmakers. Well, we have a person who follows all of that very closely so that you don't have to. It's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler. Hey, Ben, welcome back to Insight for this week's Cap Chat.
Do I have to keep following this?
Well, I hope so. We're counting on you to do it. Hey, we've discussed the budget quite a lot over the last few weeks because it's been constitutionally mandated crunch time for lawmakers. Where are we in the process? What has passed and what hasn't?
Absolutely nothing has passed, but today will be the vote, just confirmed to me by the Speaker's office, for the budget bill in chief. And what I mean by that is you think of the budget, oh, it's just a bill, right? Nope, it is a bill and a heck of a lot of other bills that go along with it. And we can get into that through the course of this segment. But today we will see votes on the budget bill itself, which includes much of, but not the entire, spending plan for the fiscal year that starts in July, because there are still, as we talked about earlier this week, there are still some significant parts of the budget that are still under negotiation between Governor Gavin Newsom and Senate President Pro Tem Tony Atkins and Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon.
And not counting the trailer bills that you mentioned, we will get into later in this segment, but the budget itself, is it just one simple up or down vote?
I guess that could be the only thing I was about to say. There's nothing simple, but I guess when you phrase it, is it just a simple up or down vote on a bill? Yeah, I mean, one in each chamber. It's going to be a vote, if we want to get technical, on the conference report from the Joint Senate Assembly Conference Committee on the Budget. There's a bill number that goes with it. It's AB 74, and there will be votes in both chambers, I believe, today on that measure.
So, Ben, there's been a lot of discussion here on Insight and elsewhere about subsidies for health insurance, including covering younger undocumented Californians and then other developments in health insurance. What can you tell us about where that stands?
Well, first of all, when we talk about trailer bills, we're still waiting to see some specifics on, we're still waiting to see a trailer bill, a bill with language implementing the budget deal for healthcare. So a lot of those details are not yet publicly available. But what our understanding is based on the conference committee compromise, as we mentioned the other day, is healthcare will be extended in Medi-Cal, California's healthcare program for low-income individuals, will be extended to young adult immigrants, 18 to 25, living in California illegally. It will not be extended to seniors, as had been proposed by immigrant groups and the Senate Democratic budget proposal. Then there's this other big piece of the puzzle, which I had a chance to talk about with Covered California's Executive Director Peter Lee the other day. Covered California, if you aren't quite sure what that is the state's health benefit exchange. And if you're not sure what that is, think of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. That's the state organization created by the Affordable Care Act that runs health insurance plans on the that offers. It's like the individual market for it. So the marketplace for you know, if you don't get coverage through your employer, you don't get coverage through Medi-Cal or Medicare, you get it through Covered California. Or currently, you can choose not to get it at all. But that's going to end at the start of this year, because under this deal, there's going to be a new state individual mandate, and that's going to replace the federal individual mandate penalty that was ended by President Trump and the Republican Congress at the end of 2017 as part of the federal tax overhaul. There's going to be a new individual mandate starting in January, and the revenue from that and some extra money from the state budget, because there's such a big surplus, is going to be going into subsidies, largely for middle-class Californians earning between $50,000 and $75,000 a year, individuals, or about $103,000 to $155,000 or so for families of four. Those are just examples. It's 400 to 600% of the federal poverty limit. So that's what is going to be going into place, paid for by the individual mandate and some extra state tax revenue.
Ben, let's listen to your conversation with Peter Lee of Covered California.
In the big picture, this proposal from the legislation of the governor means, number one, that California is saying, let's take the Affordable Care Act and build on it and make healthcare more affordable for middle-class Californians and even more affordable people that are already getting subsidies, because healthcare is too expensive. At the same time, it's saying we are going to stand up and, in essence, fight back to what's happening in Washington, D.C. by putting back the penalty that was removed by Congress, but putting it back will lower healthcare costs for all Californians. And that's the win-win on this. It's nudging people to do the right thing, to get coverage they benefit from. But it also means healthcare costs should be between 3 and 5% lower for people that don't get a subsidy. So all Californians end up being winners.
How do you know that insurance companies won't take the profit from having more people presumably being on their plans and just make a profit off it? How do you know that they're going to then lower their rates or perhaps not raise their rates as much as they otherwise would?
So one of the reasons we know that plans can't pocket this money and walk away is California has Covered California, which is set up by the people, for the people, and what we're about is holding the plans to account. We are just this week sitting down with health plans, and we negotiate hard on behalf of consumers. We look at every element that goes into the rates, including profits, and we make sure that no plans are making big profits. So they have to turn that money back to consumers. Also, they know if they price higher by 2 or 3%, they're going to lose enrollment. Because in California, we've created a market that consumers drive, not health plans, which means if a health plan thinks, oh, I'm going to leave that 3 to 5% in there and take it to the bank, they won't take it to the bank because consumers know they can switch plans and leave that health plan high and dry. So that's why we've got a win for consumers. They've got more choice, and they've got Covered California, who has their back in our negotiations.
In some parts of the state, you have more competition. In others, you don't necessarily. And a health plan could, in theory, put the extra profits in or keep the extra profits in.
Yes and no. I mean, one of the things we're looking at in this year, we had about 96% of consumers had multiple choices of health plans, with about 80% having three or more plans to choose from. So there's a very small percentage of Californians that right now only have one plan. We hope that won't be the case in 2020. We've been working very hard to make sure that consumers always have choices. And that's an issue they'll have to wait and see what we talk about in July. But we're optimistic that there will be few, if any, consumers that don't have competition throughout California in 2020.
So let's talk about the subsidies and the help that's going to be available to lower and middle class Californians, starting with Californians who earn between 200 and 400% of the federal poverty level. What's going to be available to them moving forward?
The final language is still in draft, but our current understanding is that for about 700,000 Californians who get subsidies today from the federal government will get more help, meaning their premium's going to be lowered about $15 a month per household. And that's about a 10% reduction of what they're paying now, because right now they get a lot of federal help. But $15 a month can mean the difference for people deciding to get coverage or not get coverage. It's a meaningful difference for those lower income Californians that already get some help. It's giving them a boost. It's going to make a difference.
And we should say that 400% of the federal poverty level for a single adult, that's just under $50,000 a year. For a family of four, it's about $103,000 a year. Then there's a second pot of money available for people who earn between 400 and 600% of the federal poverty level and use Covered California, or rather could use Covered California because they aren't able to get health insurance through their employers. And that is for a single adult, 600% of the federal poverty level, just under $75,000 a year. And for a family of four, a bit over $150,000 a year. What's going to be available to them?
What we have with the proposal from the governor and the legislature is, right now, If you make over that 400%, $70,000 for an individual, you'll get no financial help no matter how much your healthcare premium is. We have Californians who are working, middle class, consultants, working on their own, that may be paying 30% of their income, 28% of their income, because they're older, they live in high cost areas, and they are footing a huge bill. This financial help will mean for people that are making more money but are spending a huge share of their income, they won't need to pay as much. They may get financial help that will bring their costs down hundreds of dollars per month. Now, it's going to be based on how much healthcare costs them and where they live and those factors, but people that are hardest hit are going to get the most help. And that's the sweet spot of this deal. Now, it won't mean that everyone's going to have healthcare that's cheap. Healthcare in California is still expensive, but it means people that under the Affordable Care Act got no help. Middle-class Californians paying a huge share of their income towards premiums are going to get big assistance to make healthcare truly affordable for them.
When you couple this with the expansion of Medi-Cal to young adult immigrants living in California illegally, people may be wondering, is this all of a push toward single-payer healthcare? And it's not, right? It's a push toward universal healthcare within the existing healthcare system. Would you say that's accurate?
I would say it's very accurate. So the thing is that there's a range of proposals that are on the table. Some relate to people who are buying insurance today who are currently eligible. This builds on the Affordable Care Act and makes healthcare more affordable. The governor and the legislature have also had proposals to expand coverage to undocumented individuals. These are a track towards getting everyone in the tent because the whole community benefits when more people are covered. And healthcare costs end up being lower for everybody when you don't have people showing up in hospitals having uncompensated care. So it's part of a fabric of a system that can and should work better.
I guess the last thing I would ask is, what would you say to someone who maybe doesn't use Covered California, gets it through their employer, and just says, look, I am paying too much for healthcare. I'm paying too much in premiums. I'm paying too much in copays. I'm paying too much in specialty care visits and the like and emergency room deductibles. And this doesn't do anything to lower my healthcare costs. And maybe that's why someone is considering the potential of a single payer system. What would you say to that?
Well, the first thing I'd say to someone who has employer coverage today, how does this benefit them? Look, you've got employer coverage today. We don't want you to keep a job because of health insurance. Because of Covered California, that person can leave their job next year and know they cannot be turned away by a health insurance plan. And if they need it, get financial help. We're part of the fabric of healthcare that means you don't have job lock because of health insurance. That's number one. And number two, part of having everyone covered, it helps lower the cost for people with employer coverage. Historically, employer coverage has paid for uncompensated care. The more we get people covered, the more employer coverage isn't footing the bill for people that show up in a hospital without insurance. It's a win for people, whether or not you're directly benefiting or meaning we have a better, healthier California for everybody.
How soon will these changes for Covered California and people who use Covered California, the subsidies for all sorts of folks here that we've been talking about, how soon will these take effect?
One of the things I think is really impressive about the governor's leadership and what we've seen in the legislature is they've turned on a dime to have these policies take effect in the next plan year, which is 2020. That's right around the corner. We've already been working and developing how this is going to look. So if you have insurance in the individual market today, you'll be able to see if you're eligible for these new state subsidies starting next year, 2020. And similarly, if you think that, you know, I decided to go without health insurance, but I heard there's not a penalty, you'll need to know that starting in 2020, it looks like there's going to be a penalty if you don't get insurance in the individual market and you can afford it. Now, there's going to be exemptions. If health insurance is still way expensive for you, you won't be subject to a penalty, the same rules that apply federally. But that nudge to have everyone get under the tent who can is going to lower healthcare costs for everybody in the individual market, and it's going to help the employer sector out by avoiding those people showing up at hospitals getting care that they can't pay for.
That's Peter Lee, the executive director of Covered California, speaking with Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler, who joins us now as well. Ben, let's talk about trailer bills. They're called trailer because they follow up on the budget, correct?
A trail, yes.
Uh-huh. And as I understand it, so we'll use the building of a house as a metaphor. The framing, the walls, the windows, etc., that make up the main structure represent the actual budget. All of the other stuff, the paint, the window dressings, carpet, etc., are the trailer bills, but also are what make the house a functional home. Is that a good analogy to help understand how trailer bills work?
That works just fine. Yeah, let's go with it. I think the somewhat more technical way of putting it is the trailer bills contain language that implement what's in the budget. So the budget will say, this is the money for this, and that's the money for that. And the trailer bills will say, okay, so this money, which is starting a new program, this is how the program should work. And I think a good example of that is going to be with this individual mandate and the Covered California subsidies. The budget bill set to be approved today contains a little bit earlier of a version of language. It's going to be amended in a later budget bill coming through, hopefully in the coming weeks. But it contains about $300 million for this for subsidies, and it says there's a 75%, 25% split, you know, between middle class subsidies and lower class subsidies. But there's nothing in there on the individual mandate. There's nothing in there on how the subsidies should work, and you're going to see a lot more details fleshed out in the trailer bill whenever it becomes available. But that gets to the lack of transparency sometimes in how the budget process works, because today the bill that lawmakers are going to vote on contains the first pot of money for this new subsidy program. It does not contain anything about an individual mandate. It does not contain anything about specifics and how the subsidies are supposed to work. None of those details are public yet, and yet lawmakers are going to be asked to vote on a bill, a budget that has that and countless other provisions. And when I there's like it's a 900 plus page budget bill.
All right. Cal Matters had a great piece on trailer bills a couple of years ago. They described why they may be troubling to the party that's not in power. And of course, in California's case, that's the Republicans.
Well, because the Republicans just don't have a seat at the table right now. So up until 2010, when voters passed Proposition 26 that made a budget a majority vote required to pass, it was a two-thirds vote to pass the budget and all the accompanying legislation that would go with it. And that meant that budget negotiations were what was fondly at the time known as the Big Five, the governor and the legislative leaders of both chambers from both parties. And they would all get in a room and they would hammer things out very, very slowly over months. And when there were great budget deficits, the budget would always be late. In fact, even when there weren't big deficits, sometimes the budget would be late. So you had IOUs that the state had to issue, huge deficits, things were, you know, furloughs, things were ugly. And so Democrats, sensing an opportunity, put a ballot measure on they and their allies put a measure on the 2010 ballot requiring a majority vote instead of two-thirds for budget and trailer bills. And they decided to put a nominal stick in there saying if you don't pass the budget bill by the deadline, the constitutional June 15th deadline, lawmakers are going to get their pay docked. Well, the way it all worked out in the end is lawmakers can pass pretty much any bill they want, call it a budget bill, and even if the governor doesn't sign it, if the governor vetoes it, they're going to end up getting paid. There was a back and forth, a sparring with Jerry Brown in the first year testing it out in 2011. And for a time, lawmakers weren't paid. But then a court later ruled that they should have been paid. And so in the future, that apparently is not going to be an issue. So the main effect of this Prop 25, setting aside the pay issue, is majority vote budget. And a minority party is no longer involved in the negotiations. So they don't see these trailer bills until the public sees them a lot of times, 72 hours before the vote.
That was Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler. Thanks, Ben, for another informative Cap Chat.
If that's what you want to call it.
It was. We have more budget news on our website at capradio.org. And you are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You are listening to Insight here on Capital Public Radio. I'm Randall White. Accessing the job market can be especially difficult for adults with autism spectrum disorder, or ASD, as you'll hear it a lot in this conversation. At least one study shows they tend to earn less and have fewer job options than others their age, including people with other kinds of disabilities. But recently, companies have been working to recruit and retain these underrepresented workers. A state-funded pilot project could accelerate those efforts. It will launch soon in Sacramento, also Los Angeles. A group of adults with autism are taking the lead to build the program in Sacramento, part of what's known as Breaking Barriers. That's a pilot project. To talk about this, we're joined by Caroline Eggert, who is part of that effort. Caroline, thank you for joining us in the Insight studio.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined on the phone by Michael Burnick, a consultant for the California Workforce Association. He's an employment attorney and the former director of the California Employment Development Department. Welcome to Insight, Michael.
Thank you.
And Michael, I am going to start with you. You've been working in this specific area of employment for more than 20 years. Describe some of the major barriers adults with ASD face.
Well, first let me say that I have been working for 20 years, and things have changed a lot in the sense that, as you mentioned in the introduction, there are now a number of targeted initiatives by major companies here in California, SAP, Microsoft, J.P. Morgan Chase, probably 20 major companies that have targeted autism at work programs that we didn't have before. There are family members and others starting these autism-focused businesses. And just because of the prevalence of autism, when I first started in the 90s, early 90s, if you mentioned autism, people might know Rain Man. Now everyone says, I have a niece, nephew, neighbor. So there's a lot of interest in this that there wasn't before, and a lot of activity. Still, as you also mentioned in the introduction, the unemployment rates, the estimated unemployment rates, we really don't have a lot of good numbers, but the estimated rates are still 70% or so of our autism community adults who are not in any type of steady employment or employment more than very marginal.
And you mentioned the Rain Man comparison. To pigeonhole everyone with ASD using that one stereotype, it's just highly inaccurate. For every person with ASD, it's different, correct?
It's the first principle. The very first principle, Randall, of autism employment is, you know, if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person. The range is so great in terms of skills, interests, abilities. So I only mentioned Rain Man in at that time when I started in 1990 in the autism community. That's what people thought of. Now, of course, there's a much greater public recognition.
It was really the only high-profile example we had seen in the media, and so You really can't fault people for leaning on that. But as a society, we've really learned so much over those years. Why would you say that there is a traditionally high unemployment rate among people on the spectrum?
Well, again, it is a spectrum and a range. There are certain common, though, barriers. Some of these barriers involve interviewing and just the hiring process. But to me, a greater number of the barriers involve once one is on the job, keeping the job, and the supports necessary. Often they differ among individuals, but supports necessary on the job in terms of job coaching, in terms of buy-in from all levels of the company, so that what we've seen is that people are able to get jobs at times, but not able to keep them. And that's why I think this new program that Meristem is doing is so promising, really two reasons. One, it focuses on the retention side, and two, what it does that we haven't really seen as much is that it involves adults, young adults in this case, on the spectrum, actually designing and being involved in speaking and taking the lead, and that's a key element.
And Meristem is a school in Fair Oaks that has
trained people with autism to be successful in the workplace.
Yes.
So this new pilot program will really just greatly expand that.
It'll expand that. It'll also, really is aimed at working with employers statewide. As you said, there are two pilots, one in Sacramento and one in Los Angeles, but working with employers statewide to try to develop new models driven by young adults on the autism spectrum, new models of employment and retention.
And we have one of those very people with us right here. Caroline, you started at Meristem when you were 25.
Yes.
You're 29 now. How did this school help you grow as a person and also as a professional?
I'll start with as a person. I feel like I've gained, my confidence has grown a lot. I'm not as lonely as I was before because I used to live in Midtown and I had my own apartment, but I lived by myself and it was difficult because I got really sad and really lonely.
You found yourself self-isolating.
I did.
Uh-huh. And confidence just, it's so important.
Yeah, I feel like confidence, there are areas I could work on with my confidence, but I feel like it has gotten a lot better.
I mean, you're here on the radio right now.
I know. It's like, it's my first time on the radio, and it takes some confidence to do that. I wouldn't have been able to do this when I was 25.
And that confidence then bleeds over into your professional life.
Yes. I remember I was really nervous when I was 25 to go outside my comfort zone.
You were working for your dad at the time?
I was, full-time.
Mm-hmm.
And I do work two part-time jobs right now. I work for my dad part-time, and I work for a company called Weave part-time. Women Escaping a Violent Environment, and I think my passion lies at Weave. It's a really great cause, and I really enjoy working there.
Yeah, Weave is a well-known organization here in the Sacramento area, and you might not be doing that today if it weren't for what you learned at Meristem.
No.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have even pushed myself to apply with the help of Meristem if it wasn't for being at Meristem.
Help us understand, Caroline, misconceptions that employers might have about people on the spectrum.
Trying to put myself in the mind of the employer, if I hire someone and they tell me that they have autism or on the autism spectrum, this could be a liability for me and my company for hiring them.
So then they would be reluctant to make that hire.
Maybe they can't do the job as well. Maybe they're incapable. And it's really, I haven't experienced that firsthand, but if I were to experience that and I were on the job market looking, it would be very disheartening.
Do you think that there are employers who think that you and other people on the spectrum can do the job as well, but that they might have their own insecurities about how to interact with people on the spectrum?
I think so. I think that there might be, some people might have stereotypes. I don't think, and I think that for the most part, it's not malicious intent. It's that just thinking like, I don't know, how is this going to work out? But what I want people to know about people who have autism and might have extra struggles. Yeah, it's human to have extra struggles, whether it's in the workplace, out in the world, or both. But in the workplace, speaking for myself, and I'm sure many others, it's for myself, I aim to please. I try really hard to do a good job. I try to work my hardest when I'm at Weave and at Anton. So it's, I think,
Well, I think that one thing we try to do here on the radio is connect with our listeners so that they can really grasp what we're talking about. And you totally did that when you said that we all have struggles as humans. So you're doing pretty well. I think connecting with our listeners is what we always try to do. So Meristem has opportunities for students to learn in a lot of different areas. I understand it, ceramics, how to grow food, run a cafe. What job skills did you gain when you were there?
I learned focus. I learned just focusing on my task and not trying not to get distracted. I learned balance between if you're holding a conversation with someone while you're working at the same time, not leaning too much on the conversation, but finding a balance in your work. I learned a lot of that when I was in metals in my coppersmithing class at Meristem, especially my first and second year. And I learned good work ethic.
Yeah, coppersmithing. Wow.
I know.
I wish I knew how to do that.
Yeah.
So,
you can see, Randall, the value. She speaks more poignantly and accurately about this than anyone. That's the value of this Meristem project. It's really driven by, again, adults on the spectrum, people like Caroline, who can really speak best to how we should be developing programs in the future.
And Michael, taking that voice directly to lawmakers, as Caroline, you did, the bill that made Breaking Barriers, the pilot project, possible was SB 866. Last year, Caroline, you and fellow Meristem students spoke to legislators about the importance of the program. What was that like for you, talking to lawmakers? I mean, this is your first time on the radio, but that was your first time doing that, correct?
I know. It was exciting, but there are also some nerves because I'm not a great public speaker. I'm not naturally a great public speaker, but because it's being at the state capitol, it's pretty great by itself. But when we went into that room with the assembly people, when we had the microphones,
it can be overwhelming for anyone.
Yeah, it's.
Well, it worked. You got it passed, right?
I know. It's finding that inner courage and setting a pause. Something that I learned from someone it was a life coach that I worked with before Meristem was setting an intention for how you want it to go. Setting a positive intention and then believing in that.
We can all learn from that.
That helps.
I should clarify that SB 866 did not pass, but a bill after that did, as I understand it, to help breaking barriers. We're speaking with Meristem graduate Caroline Eggert about education and training opportunities for people with Autism Spectrum Disorder, or ASD. We're also hearing from Michael Burnick, an employment attorney and consultant for the California Workforce Association. We'd like to now add Valerie Bode Garrett to the conversation. She's a Meristem employee, and she's here in studio. Valerie, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Randall.
So, Valerie, I want to ask you to help describe your role with the Transformational Advocacy Project, or TAP. This is part of Breaking Barriers?
Yes, it is. TAP is manifesting the impulse of breaking barriers, and that's the name that the students themselves developed in our first weeks of our leadership lab, and Caroline was one of the co-chairs of that group of 12 leaders at Meristem to come up with our own name for how we're going to implement the project. So TAP is the acronym for Transformational Advocacy Project, and in the work of TAP, we aim to transform the workplace for all of those with disabilities and including those with autism.
It's in Sacramento and Los Angeles, but this is a statewide effort.
Yes, we are launching it actually today. You mentioned soon, and right now.
That's very soon.
As we speak, we have our first team at the Fair Oaks Park setting up for the first night of their summer concert series. So our first job crew is out there working in the community right now.
How will those employer trainings work?
So we have a great network of community organizations and employers who have stepped up to welcome our first 3-week jobs internship where we're actually testing our ideas on best practices in the workplace. And we're going to take what we learn from the next 3 weeks and form it into a working manual, a living document, and then we'll go and redo the program in Los Angeles and test out the newly expanded ideas toward developing a new kind of training for employers to open the doors for those on the spectrum.
Do the companies have to pay to be part of this?
Oh, no. In fact, we are paying our workers, our young adults on the spectrum, to actually have this job and to be on these crews. And I'd like to make a shout out to Dave Gaines at the Sacramento Autism and Special Needs Alliance for helping us reach out to community young adults on the spectrum beyond those at Meristem. And also we have 7 employers and organizations that have offered to open the doors and let our teams of young adults with a job coach be on site and do professional work. May I mention a few of them?
You can't. How many are we talking about?
I can speak quickly.
Yes, go ahead.
We want to mention Eschaton and House to Home Moving, Flapjack's Diner, Plates Midtown Restaurant, the Orangeville Fair Oaks Food Bank, and Fair Oaks Parks and Rec.
That was a nice short. That's good. And congrats to those places as well. Michael, I want to bring you back into the conversation here for a question that our healthcare reporter, Sammy Kayola, asked me to pass along. Historically, we've seen some adults on the spectrum working in what's called sheltered employment environments alongside other people with disabilities at less than a minimum wage. What is your take on that model?
Well, this has been a longstanding discussion in the community. My own view is that sheltered workshops do have a place. It's not the majority view, by the way, Randall, but my experience is that for a certain segment of our population, sheltered workshops, it's either sheltered workshops or nothing, and getting people out of their houses and into some activity. Now, I agree with the fact that we do have to work on ways to increase the wages and get them, if possible, up to minimum wage. But I think the sheltered workshop, and you have a great example, perhaps the best example in the state here with Pride Industries. They've had sheltered workshops for years, and they play an important role. They're not for everyone, but they're an important role for part of the population. And I think it's the thrust of policy over the past 20 years has been to try to transition away from sheltered workshops to community-based employment. And in general, that's good. But support, in my experience, supported work still has an important role.
Yeah, and breaking barriers in TAP helps to move past that, right?
Well, yeah, no, that's entirely Meristem, TAP, Valerie, Carolyn are entirely focused on community employment, and that should be the goal. But it's not always viable, and I think, we need a range of options.
I see.
Employment options, and sheltered workshops have one place to play.
So in terms of breaking barriers and TAP, Caroline, how do you hope this project will help younger generations of adults with ASD?
Something I was saying, I think it was back in January in one of our first TAP meetings, was that I hope that through our work at Meristem and through our work at TAP, that we can help. Maybe there's a 2-year-old out there who was just diagnosed with autism. Maybe we can help create a brighter future for them.
Excellent.
That's my bottom line.
That's Meristem graduate Caroline Eggert. You just heard from Caroline. Thank you so much for being on Insight, and congratulations on successfully doing your first time on the radio.
Thank you.
Also, we've been speaking to Michael Burnick, a consultant for the California Workforce Association. He's an employment attorney with Duane Morris LLP. Michael, thank you for your insight. And also TAP Program Director and Meristem employee Valerie Bode. Garrett, thank you as well for being here on Insight today.
Our pleasure.
We have more information about our discussion at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight. This is your NPR station, Capital Public Radio.
You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyek. We're turning to music now. On this week's Sound Advice, Cap Radio's jazz music director, Gary Vercelli, who you can hear on our music station, 88.9, as the host of Acid Jazz on Saturday nights, joins us to highlight notable new releases by today's top female jazz vocalists. We sat down in studio a few days ago, starting with a new track by Tierney Sutton Band.
Tierney Sutton's a veteran educator at University of Southern California, and she's mentored many of today's rising stars, including Gretchen Parlato and Sarah Gazarek. On her new album, she explores some great songs from the cinema, including a really interesting arrangement of On a Clear Day. You'll hear her interacting here with bassist Trey Henry, kind of the way Peggy Lee did when she recorded Fever.
On a clear day, rising around you, and you'll see who you are. On a clear day, how it will astound you, that the glow of your being outshines every star. You'll feel part of every mountain, sea, and shore. You can hear from far and near a world you've never heard before. Never heard before. And on a clear day, on that clear day, you can see
what a great set of pipes.
Indeed. And, you know, she's already had 8 Grammy nominations. Maybe this will be the one that
will be the next
puts her
one
over the top.
Always nominated, hasn't won at this point.
So far.
All right, let's move on to Calabria Foti.
Calabria Foti's got an angelic voice. She's also a competent violinist. She met her husband in college. His name is Bob McChesney. And she came out of a violin practice and heard this guy playing trombone, and it was love at first sound, I guess you might say.
Right.
So he's one of LA's top studio musicians, and they've assembled a really great band here in the Capitol Studios, where Nat King Cole and Frank Sinatra documented so many great hits.
The famous tower.
Yes.
Your warm and wondrous face, style and grace, I had to fall in love with you. One glance at you and I could clearly see that there could be no other love for me. It had to be from that first summer's day.
And how sweet, Gary. Did I read this correctly? This ballad was composed by her father for her mom?
Correct, yeah. And it was arranged by Johnny Mandel, a legendary composer and arranger, and her husband, Bob McChesney.
Next up is Mary Stallings.
Mary Stallings is approaching her 80th birthday, but she really makes the clock stand still. She's still as vibrant, elegant, and relevant as when she recorded with Cal Jader back in 1961. She's a native of San Francisco, and many in the jazz community feel she could have been as popular as Nancy Wilson had she not taken a break in her career to raise a family.
I don't know why, but I'm feeling so sad. I long to try something I never had. never had no kissing. Ooh, what we've been missing. Love a man, oh, where can you be? The nights are cold and I'm still all alone. I'd give my soul just to call you my own. Got a moon above me, but no one to love me. Love a man, oh, where can you be? I've heard it said that the thrill of romance can be like a heavenly dream.
Gary, who did Stallings team up with here for this song?
Pianist David Hazeltine did the arrangements, and he studied with Buddy Montgomery in Milwaukee, and Buddy goes back to San Francisco days. He's the brother of Wes Montgomery, and he and Mary used to play together in Oakland all the time. So it's kind of a still within the small community of people who appreciate yeah. Mary Stallings.
A little family reunion. Mm-hmm. Nikki Perrott, I'm saying that correctly, Perrott?
Yes, she's from Sydney, Australia. She first moved to New York in 1994. She's come out for the Sacramento Traditional Jazz Society's functions once in a while, so we know her here from the Jazz Jubilee. But she studied with Rufus Reed and Ray Brown, two top bassists, and she played bass for the legendary Les Paul for many years. She's recorded 27 albums, but a lot of them are only available in Japan on the Venus label, where jazz remains very popular and people actually still buy CDs.
Stranger, beware, there's love in the air under Paris skies. Try to be smart, don't let your heart catch on fire. Love becomes king the moment it's spring under Paris skies. Lonely hearts meet somewhere on the street of desire. Parisian love can brew high in a skylight room or in a gay cafe where hundreds of people can see. I wasn't smart and I lost my heart under Paris skies. Don't ever be a heartbroken stranger like me. Oh, I fell in love. Yes, I was a fool. For Paris can be so beautifully cruel. Paris is just a gay coquette who wants to love and then forget. Stranger, beware, there's love in the air.
I really love the accordion mixed in on Perrott's piece there.
It kind of makes you feel like you are in Paris. That's Gil Goldstein on accordion. He's also an excellent pianist and has good credentials as a composer and arranger. Our last vocalist is Kalia Ramu, and she's a rising star in her native Canada. And to me, there's little tinges of Billie Holiday in her voice.
Little one, little heart, I know that you're mine. You say that I'm sweet, but your lips just cannot be beat. You can't stay here with me, please try. So petite, little one, close your eyes and let my dreams go on. Dim the lights, dim the stars, just wrap me in your charms.
Gary, Ramu composed this?
She did, yeah. And as Sammy Davis Jr. used to say, let me leave you swinging.
That was Cap Radio's jazz music director, Gary Vercelli, highlighting notable new releases by today's top female jazz vocalists. You can find out more about the recordings Gary talked about at capradio.org/insight. And that is Insight for today. I'm Randall White. Insight is produced by Kate Gonzalez and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Today's engineer is Anthony Van Hook. Our senior producer is Helen Barrington. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Beth Ruyak will be back on Monday with another live show. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Your lips just cannot be beat. I simply don't know why you can't stay here with me. Please try, so petite little one, close your eyes and let my dreams go on. Dim the lights, dim the stars, just wrap me in your charm.